Datacraft and Rizzo presenting The Truth.
And welcome to Dread Radio. First of all, I want to say happy birthday to my co-host, Ed Kraft.
Thank you.
It sucks getting old, doesn't it, Ed?
Let's not go there.
You know what? I've got till Saturday, so you know what? It's all on you today. My birthday is not till Saturday, so it's all good.
I know. Great timing. We're doing it all at once.
You want to do it?
Well, you know what I'm
saying. I don't know you that well yet.
Hey.
Buy me a couple drinks, and then we'll talk.
I don't know. I've seen you in a dress, so I guess that counts.
What? What's that count for? You know I'm easy. I ain't cheap, though.
Hey, I don't know. Pretty cheap. Speaking
of which, there's
nothing
wrong with wearing a dress. I'm in touch with my feminine side. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, in fact,
I've gotten laid more times since I wore that dress. I love that dress now. I like having it hung up on my side of the bed.
Well, you know, speaking of that and speaking of getting laid and all that good stuff, there's a new study out, you know? And it has to do with women.
A new study about dresses and getting laid?
Well, actually, there's a new sex study out that has to do with women. Reuters has got a study that was done there in London.
It's Reuters, and I know a couple women.
I know Reuters. Reuters. I hate to say that because, you know, Reuters.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. It's your birthday. We'll lay that pass.
Yeah, let me slide on that one. But anyway, Reuters of London, out in London, rather. Reuters did a study there, or put out a news story, that young women today are nearly three times more sexually active than those of their grandmother's generation in the liberal heyday of the night swinging 60s. According to a survey on Tuesday, which of course was yesterday, the study found that women of the so-called naughties between 2000 and 2009...
That's because they're all bisexual now.
Well, they had an... Well, get this. This has nothing to do with bisexuality. Had an average sexual partners by the time they were 24. Almost
exactly. And
one
that includes
in
women
10,
too, I bet.
Well, almost one in 10 of those claim to have slept with more than 10 different partners. Now,
that
here's
includes,
the interesting thing.
That includes
thing.
Women, I'll bet you.
Well, by contrast, women who were in their early 20s in the 1960s had an average of 1.67 partners, and women in their mother's generation, aged 24 in the 1970s, had 3.72 sexual partners by the same age.
Let me just say this. Go, lesbians. Go. Get some.
Well, here's what I want to know. What poor sap or what poor dumbass guy comprises the 0.65? I mean, he doesn't even make up a whole percentage point. That's what I want to know. What poor sap
makes
up
0.65? I think that's a sex toy. How much does it resemble an actual penis? 0.65%.
Yeah, I mean, somebody out there is not even making up a whole percentage point. That's the sad part of this statistic. They don't even rank up there with a whole percentage point. I mean, think about it. Somebody is a 0.65. They don't even qualify for.
Maybe that's like a limp guy.
Percentage point. I don't know, but that's pretty sad.
You know what? Yeah, I don't want a girl rating me as 0.65. At least I want to make a 1. You know what I mean? Yeah, totally.
Has anybody ever thought about that when it comes to these statistics? Somebody doesn't even rank a whole statistic point. That's like 3.2 children. I mean, how do you rank a 0.2 child?
Might have a 0.2 child in my house right now.
You know, who is the 0.2 child? I just don't understand that when it comes to statistics.
Sorry, kid, I love you. Yeah, just kidding. Just kidding on that one.
I mean,
kind of.
I'm sorry, is that like a fetus that's unborn? I just don't understand that. I'm sorry. I just don't go for that, and I don't understand it. But, I'll get to science news because our guest today is going to love
this. Oh, goody,
this
science news.
Yeah, well, I won't say
that.
Do
you have the top 10 MTV videos, too?
No.
Oh,
don't have
great.
That yet. But,
we talked about see. That.
Oh, this happened, it's happened in France. It's actually happened on March 17th, but you know they're a day ahead of us in France, so it actually happened, I guess you'd say, here last night.
It is the 17th now here.
Right. So this this is one of those things that happened in 17. But they had a show, and this shows the character of people today in society today, and just what their mentality is toward violence and do each other in, and that kind of mentality. There's a new game show that aired there in France, and it's really interesting because what it was they had an actor on, and the contestants of the game show didn't even realize that this was a real actor. They thought it was a real person, okay?
Okay, they didn't know it was a real actor?
Or rather, they didn't know it was an actor. They thought it was
a
real person.
Go ahead, sorry.
But the makers of this French documentary, which was called The Game of Death, all right? What it is, it was completely...
Would you say The Game of Dick?
The Game of Death.
Oh, Death, sorry.
Right. And it was a documentary, The Game of Death, is what it really was. But it was a fake game show, and they set these people up, and it was called The Extreme Zone. And what they were intending to do was show the mentality of people today. The game show contestants were not offered any monetary prizes, but this guy who sat in the chair was offered, they thought was going to be offered monetary prizes to endure this. And what they did was they set this actor up in a chair, and he was faking like he was getting shocked. With how many volts was it? They told the guy he was going to get
2,493.
Actually, a maximum of 460 volts.
Oh man!
Every
just
time
a guess, he
got
sorry.
A question, you know, as long as the people in the audience wanted him or cheered him on and said, "Shock this guy!" So they had 64 of the 80 players.
That is sadistic.
Actually zapped this actor. When they were told to.
They thought they were anyways, right?
Yeah, they thought they were actually shocking this guy. 64 out of 80 players. The rest actually, six out of all that, 16 people actually quit in disgust. Only 16. Now, does that not say something about the mentality of human beings today?
People love torture, man. I've done a show on torture before, and people love torture. Look at some of the torture devices from the past. People love torture. I don't know why, because myself, I find it revolting and disgusting, and why would you want to do that? But look at the torture device, like the pear.
Oh, that's horrible.
Look at being drawn and quartered. Who the F wants to see that? But you know what? We've done that through time.
Yeah, the Roman Colosseum.
Just look at the way we kill people now. Look at the electrocution chair. That's okay, a lot of people think, okay, you're going to put a guy in a chair, strap him in, and you electrocute him and he's dead. It does not work that way. People's eyeballs pop out. They foam at the mouth. They do not die quick. Even lethal injection, you suffer still. Okay? And people have to watch that as witnesses.
It's gross. Well, it's gotten really outrageous. Before we go on, I think we'll go ahead and introduce our guest or let him in. Our guest again tonight is Thomas J. Carey.
Thomas, what's your favorite form of torture?
Tom, you there?
Oh, yes.
Thomas, right. Thomas, what's your favorite or unfavorite form of torture?
Oh my goodness, I've never thought about it, but I don't like any torture. To give you an example, the History Channel. I think it was the History Channel. They ran a show on medieval torture.
Yeah.
You know, and those ancients, they seemed to be obsessed with torture.
Yes, they did. I would agree.
And they had all of these contraptions to really torture people, and I started watching it, and before they get through the first item, I turned it off. I just couldn't take it. So human suffering. I just don't. It's not one of my favorites.
What bothers me is the amount of energy people put into figuring out how to torture people.
Well, why? I don't understand. Why would you want to torture somebody? I just don't get it. I think. In the ancient times and medieval times, a lot of life was desperate, and you had the powerful and the weak, and the powerful, I guess they felt that they could do anything.
You had the controlling and the controlled.
Yes, it's like even as recently as World War II. And I guess even after Vietnam with Pol Pot, but in World War II, you had those that thought they were all powerful, and they just wreaked havoc on the powerless.
I couldn't agree more. So, you know what? I don't want to be racist, but it seems like the people from like Vietnam, North and South Vietnam, the Chinese are far more tolerant of torture, and even in the Middle East these days. You know, when you take a soldier and you chop his head off with a saw.
Yes.
You know, I just don't understand that thinking. They're far more tolerant of human suffering than we here in America are, and I think that's probably, I don't want to call it a weakness, because that's a tricky word, you know, but when we see that, we just go, you know what, we don't want no part of that, let's back out of that. Our soldiers are being killed in this manner, so let's back off from that. But these guys,
well, you know, during World War II, you could call me like a World War II buff. I'm certainly no expert, but I've read a lot about World War II, and fighting the Japanese. This is sort of a topical subject with the things that Tom Hanks had to say about racism and war. But there are two axioms when in all wars. One is the first casualty of war is truth.
Yep.
And the second casualty is that you have to demonize and dehumanize your enemy. That goes for any side. You dehumanize them and demonize them.
Because
you know,
if
to
you
get
look
your,
them in the eye, you're less likely to kill that person.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Now, everybody thinks, you know, it was because of the Japanese sneak attack at, Pearl Harbor that... certainly it kindled our outrage in the beginning, but what really outraged all civilized, or at least the Western, let's say the Western allies, was the Japanese treatment of prisoners of war was absolutely barbaric.
Yep.
And that, even as much as the Pearl Harbor attack, just outraged our citizens, and, it stayed with us, the whole entire war.
And I would have to say the kamikazes who would take their own life, kill themselves, and that was like the first form of terrorism, like what we see today, people blowing themselves up. The Japanese actually, if I might be wrong, but from my understanding, the Japanese were the first ones to do that. Where they would actually they'd take their own life and take out their enemy along with them and be happy with it.
Well, they certainly perfected it.
In modern warfare, anyways.
Yeah, well, that was a tactic that they thought they were going to. I'm no expert on what is it, Shintoism or something. I think it's Buddhism.
Right.
Yeah, but they would go on to the happy hereafter.
Yep.
But that was a tactic that they used in desperation.
Yep.
It was it wasn't employed until they were really desperate. They were short of pilots and. This made them even shorter on pilots.
And we were not used to that. We were used to going out and, you fight until you die, but you don't go in there and just blow yourself up and kill the enemy, you know?
Well, that's what they're doing today, aren't they?
That's what I was saying. The Japanese probably... And you know what? The Chinese a little bit, because you know what? Their culture kind of overlaps a little bit.
Yeah.
They would actually, you know what? They would think it was good for their culture if they could kill themselves. It would be noble for them to kill themselves. I'm sorry, lack of a better term, noble to kill themselves and take the enemy out and go to a higher place where they would be awarded with gifts or they'd go to heaven if they could just further their own culture and their own people. And you know what? If you took the enemy out, you know what? You were a saint.
Well, this goes for all wars ever since the there were wars that you, in order to continue the fight and energize your own people, you have to dehumanize the other side and make them the devil or what have you. But in the case of the Japanese, they were absolutely in fact their culture thought they thought prisoners of war, you just you should kill yourself before becoming a prisoner of war, and they had no respect at all for prisoners of war. Even their own, that were taken by the Allies, but they treated Allied prisoners of war much worse than the Germans did. And
I think that's because of their mindset, where anyone who was captured was weak, so they treated prisoners as weak, so they had no respect for them, and they had there was no dignity, there was no compassion, you know?
Actually, it has to do with the fact that, number one, the Germans did sign the Geneva Pact, and the Japanese did not.
Yeah, but the Germans signed it, but they didn't mean it.
Well, yeah, but they stuck to it more than the Japanese had no obligation to stick to it.
And the Germans didn't either. They didn't care. They signed things just to sign them.
Yeah, but they did, when it came to prisoners of war, they did stick to it somewhat.
Well, maybe, you know, and maybe that's the moral compass of some of the Germans, and kudos to that. But I think the Germans, as their leadership, did not give a rat's ass about those treaties they signed. They signed them just to sign them, and they did what they want. Look how they treated people. I mean, it was
right,
horrible.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but when it came to prisoners of war, that was a little different story. But yes, they on the overall, I'm not defending the Nazis in any way.
No,
don't misunderstand.
On the other hand, the Germans in on the Eastern Front, they were not kind to prisoners of war. It was only the Western Allies that they were. I won't say were kind, but they did. Hold to some rules of prisonership.
I'm wondering if they knew what was coming, and maybe that's why, because the Germans seemed to care if there was consequences for their actions. You know what I mean?
Well, I was trying to say that on the Eastern Front, where they captured many, many, many millions of more Russian prisoners than Western allies, they didn't feed them. They just put them in large stockades and just let them starve to death. Now that's the way it was on the Eastern Front as opposed to the Western Front.
Yeah.
So the fight on the Eastern Front was a fight to the death. That's what it was.
You know what? That fight on the Eastern Front was nothing less than hell on earth, in my opinion. I mean, reading about it and looking in,
yes,
just studying it.
It made the Western Front look like a almost a civilized action, but
yeah,
the Eastern Front was just absolutely anything went on,
yep,
both sides.
Yep.
It was savage.
Kind of bless the Russians for that, because the Russians couldn't have done what they achieved if they hadn't been that way. They had to be that way.
Let's get off the subject of death and destruction here. I mean, this is St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, this is St. Patrick's Day. I mean, enough with torture and death.
I'm still wearing my green shirt.
Yeah, this is a time for celebration.
I've got a tattoo with green in it, so I'm safe.
Enough of the death and downtrodden stuff here. I think it was started with the question,
what do I think of torture?
I think it was a great conversation, actually. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. We can come back to it. Let's look at some of the history here of the St. Patrick's Day itself, since you know it is St. Patrick's Day. Number one, either of you got a clue why we pinch people who aren't wearing green? Since you mentioned green,
why we what?
Why do we pinch people who aren't wearing green on
because
St.
they suck?
I've never heard of that. Is that a tradition?
Yeah,
pinching people that don't wear green.
I've been pinching Polly all day.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah,
sorry, Polly.
It's actually an American tradition that started about the 1700s. And the reason is, they thought if you wore green, it made you invisible to the leprechauns. Yeah,
oh my goodness.
Which is good, because what happened was, the leprechauns would actually pinch you, the reason it made you invisible, or rather, green would make you invisible, which was good, because if you weren't invisible, the leprechauns would pinch anyone they could see. So the pinching is actually to warn and remind you about the leprechauns.
Well, for someone who's Irish, I'm not upholding my end here.
Well, again, it's an American tradition. It's not an Irish thing. It's something that was created here in America.
Yeah. Americans always have to funk things up.
Well, we create our own.
By the way, F-U-N-K.
I am wearing my green shirt, though, still, during this interview.
Oh, I believe me, we're heading out tonight, so.
You better be wearing green, Ed.
Yes, I'm wearing my green. Okay. I've got my green pants on anyway right now. But I'll have my green shirts and suspenders, which, by the way, came from Ireland. Brought them back, so...
Nice.
Let's see. Oh, here's another one. How about a New York ferry worker that got suspended? And this is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. It happened today. An Irish-American ferry worker was actually suspended from his job in New York's Staten Island Ferry for being caught stamping shamrocks all over the boat to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. And this
What was he doing with the shamrocks?
It was one of those little ink stamp pads.
Oh, yes.
He was literally stamping on shamrocks.
No, he took the little stamp pad and stamped them all over the thing. It says, the man, Jared Largo, said he was trying to spread Irish cheer ahead of today's St. Patrick's Day festivities. The rubber stamp, using a black ink pad, were about 3 inches wide in the shape of the Irish clover. Largo, who was the mate on the ferry and sometimes steers the boat, stamped the area around the ferry's wheelhouse as well as near the time clock where employees check in for duty. And he quoted, I look at it at the same as the same thing as Christmas decorations, end quote, he told the New York Times. He said he planned to wash off the stamps after the holiday. He wanted acceptance to his he wasn't applicable to his bosses. Anyway, when he showed up in court, believe it or not, he was actually wearing a green tux and green shoes.
Okay, so this made the New York Times, you're saying.
Yeah.
Was he fired?
Yes, he was fired.
How many sheets to the wind was he?
I have no idea. They didn't say he was drunk. They
as just long said as there were green it. Sheets.
They caught him on camera, and they claimed it was because they considered it defacing the property and vandalism.
Certainly was that. Irish aside, it certainly was that. That would be the way I would, try to.
Yeah, you know what? If I was Irish, I'm a little bit Irish, and I'm still kind of pissed off. You take an ink stamp?
It was just an ink stamp, and he said he was just going to wash it off after the holiday.
That's kind of cheesy, though.
That's kind of cheesy, and but that just goes to show you how people get on this holiday. I'm like you.
Well, it was certainly. Defacing property. I mean, technically, that's true.
Yeah, he was.
I don't know that he should have been fired. Maybe they should have taken him up on getting the things off, washing them off.
Yeah, or slapped him.
Well, I put it this way: if the guy shows up in court in the review board for all this wearing green shoes and a green thing, I think it was like you, three sheets to the wind. You know what I'm saying? This guy was not all there.
Yeah, amen to that.
I mean, I think he was hitting the bottle a little too early. Or at least
he was. What was
for his own good?
I take it he wasn't a brain surgeon.
He was a rocket scientist. Good guess.
They only let him steer the boat occasionally. So what does that tell you? They didn't.
That's not a good thing.
Turns out he works for NASA.
Yeah, this guy was not a brain surgeon. Let's see. Records open with Obama. Oh, here you go. This one, everybody should love. You guys, I'm sure. I have my Guinness on St. Patty's Day.
Oh God!
I think a lot of you guys are out there doing it. Here's a great one.
I'm actually drinking malt liquor today.
A new use for Guinness.
It's a green bottle.
Believe it or not. This actually has to do with cooking with Guinness. A lot of you folks out there have probably never tried this, but here's a bunch of recipes for Guinness, using Guinness with. How about beef braised in Guinness? Chunks of beef are browned with bacon and onions, then braised until tender in Guinness and beef stock.
Good.
Another one, Irish cheddar and stout fondue. Perfect St. Patrick's Day party dish. This fondue uses Irish cheddar and stout in place of the traditional... what is it? Gruy and white wine. I think that's
it. What is that? What in white wine?
Gruyere. I don't know what that is. I think it's some kind of funky.
I can say for the record, if you're going to saute mushrooms, pour some beer in there with some Worcestershire sauce.
Oh, that's really good.
It's always good, trust me. A little bit of butter.
Let's see. Warm German potato salad. Try using Guinness for the tangy beer sauce.
Oh,
it's tossed with warm potato slices, fresh herbs, bacon, and hard-boiled eggs in this hearty side dish.
That sounds too bad, actually.
Not before you go to bed, though.
Yeah, no, that.
That can get pretty rough later at night. Now, this is where we really, really, really get weird. chocolate Guinness cupcakes.
Oh, man. Are you kidding me?
Stop right there.
Yes,
Guinness chocolatey, chocolate coffee undertones make it a naturally fit, natural fit for chocolate dessert. Here, cupcakes get a flavorful boost with the addition of stout, then are finished off with a smooth cream cheese frosting.
Wow.
Okay, the frosting
sounds good.
This is
after that previous dish, right?
Man. Yeah. Welsh, now rare bit bites. Now, this is R-A-R-E-B-I-T, bites. Toasted slices of B-A-G-U-E-T-T-E, I have no clue what that is, are topped with a melty cheddar, Guinness, and mustard sauce for an easy hors d'oeuvre.
Ooh.
Yuck.
I don't know about that one. Be close to home when you're, if you have something like either be home or close to home.
Yeah.
Actually, it doesn't look too bad from the picture, but Guinness Stout Marinade. Guinness lime juice and fresh herbs are blended together for an all-purpose beef
marinade. Okay, that one sounds okay, actually.
All right, this one sounds really gross. Guinness milk chocolate ice cream.
Okay, no.
This usual ice cream features the hearty flavor of Guinness blended with creamy milk chocolate and a hint of vanilla.
That's not going to happen.
I can't imagine beer with ice cream. I guess it happens, but...
I've actually had a beer float. That actually is pretty good.
A beer float?
Yep, beer and ice cream.
Okay, girls, give me some ice cream.
That's pretty good. That actually is not bad. Guinness pub burgers. Adding Guinness to
Guinness,
a burger.
Wait. Go back. Guinness what?
A Guinness pub burger.
Okay.
P-U-P burger. Adding Guinness to these burgers keeps them juicy and enhances their beefiness.
Wait, how do you add beer to burgers? You pour it over the burgers or what?
You pour it over the burger, and when you're making the burger...
Okay, that's like stretching right
like,
there.
Worcestershire.
That sounds pretty good.
Worcestershire, I can understand, but beer kind of runs off.
Beer and ice cream turns my stomach just the thought of it.
Yes, bless you for that. I have to concur on that one.
Number 9 out of 10 is gingerbread with stout. Stout gives the gingerbread a dark, rich flavor and keeps it from being too sweet.
I was just going to say gingerbread's too sweet for me, but if it kills the sweetness, maybe you got something.
Yeah, the bitter
there.
Must kill the sweet.
And last but not least, out of number 10, cheddar beer dip with smoked sausage. A bubbly cheese dip full of hearty stout and smoked sausage bits. Good served with pretzels or cut up vegetables.
Sounds like a winner.
Now that sounds really good to me.
Yeah, that's a winner.
There you folks have it. I'm wanting to stay away from the ice cream bits and all that mess. The meat dishes sound pretty good. As far as that goes. So, there you have your stuff for St. Patrick's Day.
And on that note, it's time for a break.
Yeah, we're right on the half hour.
Yep, I'm going to play some Flogging Molly, Black Friday Rules. This is Irish music for, St. Patty's Day.
And we'll be back with our guest today, Thomas J. Carey, author of Witness to Roswell.
Yes, we will. This is Dread Radio, by the way. Be back
hey,
in
Ed,
7 minutes. 7 minutes, 1.1 seconds, you guys.
To believe in myself once again, so I dream of a man whose hopes never end. To kiss with a girl who's as lovely as you, I'd give you my heart if you gave me the truth. And for every tear that is lost from an eye, I'd dig me a well where no man could destroy. Drink till Still, oh mother of Jesus, I feel pretty ill. I want to go home where my people feel safe, but there ain't no jobs in the old free state, so I must remain in my new doctor lab. I'm doing the best and I'm doing all I can, so next time you see me, don't ask for my name.
Welcome back live here to Dread Radio. I'm Ed Kraft, along with Reap So, and our guest today, Thomas J. Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell.
I want to thank Thomas for coming back on the show again, by the way.
Yeah, this is our part two.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, fellas. I never am disappointed to talk about Roswell.
Yeah, good.
Well, we've talked about so much today. I mean, we haven't even touched the bucket on that one yet. But we're kind of going over some of the news and other stuff.
As long as the conversation flows, we're all good.
Yeah. Well, we never stay on topic half the time here anyway. Yeah. But what were we talking about? Oh, we're covering just some of the news stuff. And one of the things that's out there. Now, Tom, you've got research. You've done research and studied in other areas. But there's one thing that's been out there recently in the news that is kind of off-topic as far as your work and research. I know you and Don have gone out to Roswell and done some digs out there, some archaeological work out there. And this has to do with that area that they recently, I believe it's out in Indonesia, an Indonesian island, where they've actually discovered potentially the ancestors of a hobbit-like species of humans that colonized an Indonesian island of Flores as far back as a million years ago, much earlier than they thought ever existed. Have you kept up with that news?
I haven't really kept up with it, but I know what you're talking about. The Hobbit is like a little fictional creature. I don't know who wrote the fictionalized story that they take the name from. But they've dubbed this diminutive human, I won't say that it's an ancestor of modern man, but certainly...
J.R. Tolkien, I think, is the guy.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
But these little humans, let's call them little humans, because they were human. It's not that they were monkeys or apes or anything like that. They were humans, but very, very small. Now, they lived at a time when humans were also just, you know, taller than that, certainly. Certainly on the road to a modern man, there were humans around at that time. So this group of little diminutive humans, that what had to have happened is that they had to have a degree of isolation for this to happen. Because the human species is very, well, we won't say gregarious, but they are mobile, and genes tend to flow rather...
It follows the chain of events, if you will.
Yeah, genes tend to flow fairly rapidly in human populations, but this one population of diminutive humans had to have remained isolated for some period of thousands and thousands of years to not have been influenced by the genes of other populations.
So you'd have to look at evolution to go backwards and make these people smaller, right?
Well, evolution, human evolution, going backwards. The so-called, they used to call it the missing link, you know, something between apes and humans, but really it's a connecting link, common ancestor theory, hypothesis, that we subscribe to, where at one point apes and humans shared a common ancestor. But what we find out over the years, I know since I started, inquiring in this particular discipline back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, is that common ancestor time has come closer and closer and closer and closer to the present. So this particular population of humans occurred sometime well after that. They were definitely human, but for some reason whether it was genetic drift, where they had an odd combination of the human genome to where they were small, they remained in isolation to remain that small for so long. So It's an oddity. I would not say they're on the the direct line of human ancestor, but they were a side branch that remained very curious to us today.
And not to kill the conversation, but the actual term Hobbit comes from the Lord of the Rings, for the record.
Lord of the Rings? Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. You know what? Whatever you want to call it, I mean, that doesn't kill the evidence, of the story, but the actual term comes from Lord of the Rings, so there, take that for what you will.
Yeah. No, it's, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I would... besides paying all the outstanding bills, right? I would go on these digs. That's what I really love to do is go
Can
on these.
Can I get
these,
a nice junker? Could you spare some for me? I need a nice junker, not a nice car, just a junker.
Well, I would go on these archaeological and paleontological digs because I just love that stuff. So, but. I guess this was written up in either Nature or Science, like that. I even think there was a it's either History Channel or one of those has done a show on The Hobbit. And I will make a promise to you: the next time it's on, I will watch it.
This was reported. I actually just accidentally closed out the page, but it was a recent news article in the last 2 days where they just did a dig in China or rather Indonesia and stumbled upon. The remnants of the tools and the society itself, and they actually found that the tools that they were using and everything else.
Did they ascribe a date to it?
They did, but I actually closed the page. I have to go back and dig it out. I accidentally closed the page as I was sitting here talking to you guys. I'll look it back up. It's on ABC News, I believe, that I found it, but it's all over the place.
Yeah, because modern humans go back. It used to be like 40,000 years, but now they've gone back. They've have modern, so-called modern populations back 100,000 years ago. So if it was more recent than that, they would be living at the time of modern humans. Prior to 100,000 years, they would be something else again. So the date's all important here as to what they think when these hobbits lived.
Yeah, it was actually far earlier. It was earlier, much earlier than they thought they existed. I did read that much out, but it was isolated on this one island. So it does make a lot of sense, and everything is being confirmed. And yes, it was much earlier, and that it was definitely isolated. So
that's what you need for aberrant or aberrant populations to come about is you do need genetic isolation, which is caused by most notably you're an island way out in the middle of nowhere. You do not have access to other breeding populations, so that's how they call it geographic isolation. That's the main way they do it.
All right.
Well, they don't do it. It just happens. So,
well, let's see. We've got I think we've got two more, but the last two are going to go into. Actually, we've got three more, but the last two topics, as far as news goes, actually goes into our main topic tonight. So I'll save those. But we got one interesting topic here that we've talked a bit about in the past, and this one's really interesting because we've always hit on, and I know this one's really going to hit right at home. But it actually kind of hits me, too. But this has to do with a very interesting story I stumbled across today. And, Reap and I both agree on this. It's a subject that, really doesn't sit well with me. I don't think it sits well with him because of the fact that exorcisms, I think, are very debatable.
Don't even go to exorcisms, please.
Yeah. Well, this has to do with an article that says, Satan is in the Vatican. Catholic exorcist says. Believe it or not, the Reverend Gabriel Amorth, Amorth, the man who has served as the Vatican's chief exorcist, that's the Vatican's own.
You know what's
chief
funny?
Exorcist.
The Vatican wants to distance themselves from exorcisms as much as they can these days.
Well, this is their own chief exorcist for 25 years, says the signs are there, the devil has infiltrated St. Peter's. Specifically,
Amorth's
site.
From?
This is from, where am I citing this? AOL. This is from AOL News.
Ah, okay, that makes sense.
All right. Actually has his own words, his picture, the whole nine yards. Specifically, Amorth cites recent sexual abuse and pedophilia scandals, as well as what he deems a cover-up and the shooting deaths of two of the Vatican's Swiss guards and one of the guards' wives as proof of the Catholic Church's most infamous, most famous site in less than pure. He quotes, and I quote here, "When one speaks of the smoke of Satan in the holy rooms, it is all true, including these latest stories of violence and pedophilia." Okay. Amorth has cited as saying, "The Times of London, the smoke of Satan's reference is a phrase coined by Pope Paul VI."
Okay, can I rant for just a second here?
Okay, we're on, you're on the
please,
clock.
Let me just rant just for a second.
You're
because
on the
I've,
clock.
I've studied a lot of the Bible and a lot of Catholicism. I know in the original text of the Bible, there is no mention of hell, okay? Demons, this is really, really easy. And for anyone who doesn't understand it, let me clarify it for you. Okay, the concept of hell and demons are a man-made concept by the church, mostly the Catholics, but the Christians like to get involved in it. Because you know what? If they can tell you you're going to hell, then there's some kind of repercussions for your actions. And it's the only way they can control you, okay? The whole concept of hell. Hell is not mentioned one single time. Not once. And I can't emphasize that enough. One single time in the original text of the Bible. It is translated into several different things. The pit, the hole, okay, the dark place. But it is never translated the same way. And that's because King James and his... whatever you want to call it, and all his interpreters, okay, and the way he wanted to control the population, wanted you to think you were going to hell, because if you didn't think you were going to hell, you wouldn't follow what the Bible told you to do. Because as people, sometimes, and hopefully not myself included, people are jackasses, okay? They do not care about other people. They don't have empathy. So they needed a way to threaten people. Okay, I've said this many, many times. This is like a thorn in my side and one of my pet peeves, and I don't mean to rant. Well, I kind of mean to rant. But you guys need to stop and read this book, okay, and understand exactly what's going on. There are no such thing as demons. Exorcisms are not what you need. What you need is to get mental, professional help for these people who think they are possessed by demons. Okay, there's my rant. Thank you very much, Jim.
All right, and I would be in agreement, but
I can't say it enough times.
All right, and I'd be in agreement for the most part. However, I think the point of this, and I think the point, you know, all the demon stuff aside, I think what this priest is actually is doing here is basically coming out and saying that the church is covering up. I think what he's really doing here is saying that he's fed up with the scandals and the evilness that the church is covering up. That's what it really sounds like he's doing
here. Yeah, but you know what? Church. Even to bring demons into it in any context is ridiculous.
Well, that may be the case, but I think the underlying thing is this guy's fed up with what's really going on.
I don't blame him. I'm fed up, too.
I think that's the gist of what's going on here, because let's see. Let me skip down a little bit here where it actually says, and he continues with his rant, but his own rant, but it actually says here, Armworth, who was founder and president of Honor Association of Exorcists, became the official exorcist of the Catholic Church in 1986. The Times reports, but Armsworth's diagnosis may not mean that the church is preparing a Vatican exorcist anytime soon. Saying that Armworth had gone well beyond the evidence for satanic possession of the Vatican, Rome-based exorcist, the Reverend Jose Antonio Forte Cuculli, told the Times, quote, "Cardinals might be better or worse, but all have upright intentions and seek the glory of God," end quote.
Yeah.
In other words, he didn't address the problems that the other priest was addressing. The other priest basically said there are problems in the church that need to be addressed, and the Vatican's official stance is, well, they have good intentions, so we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's just sad.
You know, and I think that's the underlying point here, is that this one guy is saying, well, there's demons here because, you know, the church is corrupt. And the other guy is saying, well, we'll let it be because their intentions are good.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah. Try to get an exorcism performed by the Vatican now and see what you get.
Well, I think what the first priest is basically saying is the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Well, yeah, I would have to concur with that, yes.
If I mean, that's what I'm reading here. That's what I'm basically...
I don't mean to rant, but you know what? This is one thing that really gets me pissed off because there are so many people, Christian fundamentalists and a lot of Catholics who are playing this devil or Satanism card and using that to justify some bad actions by people who have no morals. And it's wrong. You got to stop doing that.
Yeah, and I'm not saying the whole everybody that's there or does that has bad intentions. I'm just saying that
I have no fault with religious beliefs. Don't get me wrong. I'm not mad about Catholics or Christians. You know, if it does you good, it's all good for you. But you have to acknowledge the history of the text you believe in and you live your life by.
I agree.
Please. Yeah. That's not too much to ask, I don't think.
Yeah, a few rotten apples can spoil the bunch, and
yes,
I think that's what this priest is saying, you know. He's had enough of the rotten apples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's basically what I'm seeing here. You know, and he's coming forward and saying that, so I'm with you. You know, this guy, kudos to this guy. And now, let's see, before we get into our topic, here's the last two. And, you know, we're going to talk about the Roswell crash today, so this seems pretty appropriate, kind of in an ironic way, but in a humorous way. But in Montreal... what happened was, get this, we've all heard of these ultralight planes. You know, the ones that run off of lawnmower engines?
Well, I tried to build one of those when I was a kid.
Well, a pilot actually of an ultralight, and this, you know, we've heard of these guys that get up here and do it. The plane's 53-year-old pilot, actually, you know, he suffered some minor injuries when this thing crashed, and he had a 17-year-old son with him. Who didn't suffer any injury. So, you know, this is not one of those things that turned out bad.
Yeah.
But we hear about these things falling out of the sky all the time. Well, get this. You know, planes hit houses all the time, and they usually hit somebody else's house.
Is this the jogger story?
Well, this guy goes up, and get this. He crashes into his own house for a change.
Oh, okay. All right.
He doesn't crash into somebody else's. This idiot goes up and crashes into his own house.
How ironic is that?
Yeah, he takes off. He tries to pull some crazy maneuver right after takeof, and he crashes into his own house. How ironic is that? You know, he's going to go up there, be an idiot, and show off for his son or his son, and he crashes into his own house.
At least they weren't hurt, right?
Well, no, he was injured a little bit. It said his minor injuries. His son was unhurt at all, but he got some minor injuries.
I don't want to wish any ill will on people to get hurt, but you know what? There's sometimes you just have to laugh and just shake your head.
He went through a window and crashed through it, and he got some cuts, but some minor cuts and stuff, obviously. But, you know, the police are continuing to investigate the plane crash directly into the house that ended up hitting it after landing. They want to determine if it was after he landed or whether he drove the plane right into it.
Man.
They're not sure how he actually pulled this thing off, but
you know,
they are sure that he tried to pull a stupid stunt right after he took off.
On that same note, did you hear about the guy who was jogging down the beach and the plane crashed and actually he couldn't hear it because the engine all cut out and he got took out by the plane?
No.
This is like yesterday, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, it was on, I listen to talk radio all the time because I'm a geek, but it was on KCBS, I think, where they're talking about this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, I've got one last story here.
Okay,
and
then we'll
I'm
take a break,
this
and then
for
we'll get
after
back
the
into
break,
Roswell.
Because this is going to get us right into Roswell and government secrecy and cover-up. So let's do that, and we'll come back to this one and Roswell, right. And our guest Tom Carey.
Take a break first, or?
Yeah, let's do that, because this will take us right into our topic, and our guest will be able to pick right up on it.
Okay, so let's play some more Irish music, if you will.
All right.
How about a little Devil's Dance Floor? Seems appropriate.
All right.
All right, we'll be back in 3 minutes, 58.6 seconds, Dread Radio. We'll be right back.
than me. Color of her eyes were the color of insanity. Crushed beneath her wave like a ship I could not reach the shore. We're all just dancers, all the devil's dancing for. Well, swing a little more. Her insecurity might have been a drunk and her father was obscurity. Nothing ever came from a life that was a simple one. Pull yourself together, girl, have a little fun. Well, she took me by the hand, I could see she was a furry one. Her legs ran all the way up to heaven and past Avalon. Tell me something, girl, what it is you have in store. She said, come with me now, I'm the devil's bounce floor. Well, swing a little more.
Welcome back live here to Dread Radio. I'm Matt Kraft with Reap Show, and our guest today, Tom J. Carey, co-author of Witness to Roswell, along with his co-author, Donald R. Schmidt. And happy St. Patty's Day to everyone out there. You're listening to us tonight live on Pulse Radio, pulseradioonline.net. And, of course, you can hear us again tomorrow at, 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And
on jackalope.com.
9 p.m. Eastern Time on Jackalope 105 FM. And tonight we're going to talk a little about Roswell. But before we get into that, I want to read you our final article because we were just debating this and talking about it during the break. And this has to do with something interesting with the Obama administration. And he's ordered in Freedom of Information Act. He's actually ordered his administration to open up records and be more... I guess, transparent, but apparently there's some, I guess you would call it, dissidence amongst the ranks, particularly within the Justice Department. 1 year ago, he, of course, promised greater government transparency, and this comes from ABC News, directly from ABC News. But 1 year ago, on its promise of greater government transparency, the Obama administration is more often citing exceptions to the nation's open record law to withhold federal records even as the number of requests for information declines. According to a review by the Associated Press of agency audits about the Freedom of Information Act, among the most frequently cited reasons for keeping records secret, one that Obama specifically told agencies to stop using so frequently. The Freedom of Information Act exemption, known as the deliberative process exemption, lets the government withhold records that describe its decision-making behind the scenes. Obama's directive memorialized in written instructions from the Justice Department appears to have been widely ignored. Major agencies cited the exemption at least 70,779 times during the 2009 budget year, up from 47,395 times during President George W. Bush's final full budget year, according to annual reports filed by federal agencies. Obama was president for 9 months in the 2009 year period. Now, is that not amazing?
It is amazing.
I mean, my chin hit the ground because the requests have declined and the number of turndowns have gone up. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It kind of makes sense. Well, I mean, we talked about this on the break. Go ahead.
My own opinion, I read that piece a few days ago, or one like it, and it sort of flies in the face of Obama's promise to have a transparent government, which would, to me, seem to increase the number of FOIA requests. And for them to keep citing some obscure technicality not to respond, to me, suggest several possibilities. One, they're short of staff. They just can't handle the flood or the amount of requests, and so they turn down most of them because they just can't handle them, and they pick out a technicality. Oh, here we can use this, and so they go on to the next one.
That's their route.
The other possibility to me is that they do not want to release things that have been under wraps for decades. There's a reason that they're not being released for all these years, and they're not going to rock the boat. They're just going to keep the status quo, because either it will make certain personalities look bad, certain political parties look bad. So there's some reason these things are not being released that have nothing to do with national security. Certainly some of them do, and I can respect that, but a lot of them have to do with making
saving
certain
space.
People look bad, and they don't want to release that information. So, but the problem is that Obama has promised a transparent government, and this flies right in the face of that. As for me, in Roswell, UFO buffs, UFO investigators are one of those groups that file a lot of FOIA, Freedom of Information requests, right? They're always...
Yeah.
There's this fellow in Maryland, Larry Bryan, he shoots off 10 a day, you know, in my 20 years on the Roswell case, I have yet to file one. I just don't, I wouldn't be able to take the frustration of not being, I take that back. No, it was a letter. It wasn't a request. It was a letter to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and all I wanted from him was his opinion as to a certain promulgation that the Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Widnall, issued in 1994, to see if I did was ask him if that was still in effect, absolving Roswell. Military people who were stationed at Roswell who had information. She issued a promulgation in 1994 to waive any security oath that they might have sworn to remain silent, or believe that they were still under to remain silent. She issued proclamation that those secrecy oaths no longer applied and they were free to speak. I wanted to find out from the chief of staff of the Air Force whether that promulgation was still in effect. And I wrote him, it must be 4 years ago, and I'm still waiting for an answer. So I don't do the Freedom of Information Acts, because they're going to keep secret what they want to keep secret. And from my understanding, things that they do release are heavily redacted, so the things that you want to know, you can't make sense of, because they're all redacted. So my mandate is to interview as many witnesses that are still living as I can. And this freedom of information, certainly it's a tool. In when was Carter president? 1978.
Oh, Lord. It's been it's a long time ago.
Yeah, well, they released, under the Carter administration, is probably the only good thing, at least in my mind, I hope I'm not offending anybody, that he accomplished, is he released a lot of documents that had been kept secret for decades. And it helped a lot of researchers, especially on things relating to World War II. And we haven't had any document dumps, as they call them, or release of information since then. So when Obama took office, I know in the UFO community, such as it is, there was great hope that Obama was going to release the UFO files, you know, what really took place. And it's my belief that whether it's Obama or Bush or whoever, those files will never be released. They will never be released. And I think one of the reasons is what they did at Roswell. They don't ever want to release that, so they don't release anything that's substantive regarding UFOs, at least in my opinion. I know some other countries have, but still, if you look at the information they have released, these other countries aren't coming out and saying, yes, UFOs are absolutely real. They're just document dumps, and people can make out conclude what they want. But there's no official declaration from these countries that, yes, UFOs, i.e., spaceships from another planet, are real. That has not happened, and it won't happen. So,
well, I've seen photographs where the governments actually try to use and explain away landed pictures of UFOs or crashed sightings of UFOs as things like the Viking Mars lander, you know, where they would drop it from parachutes.
Right. Well, they think we're dopes. They think we're dopes. You know, a good example of that was the 1964, April 64 Socorro case. The sheriff deputy named Lonnie Zamora near Socorro, New Mexico, and Don Schmidt and I actually visited that site in December, just a few months ago. And Zamora was chasing a speeder when he saw a bright flash off to out the windshield, and he stopped. He was so intrigued by this that he stopped. The speeder got away. And he got out of his car, and we actually stood on the spot where Lonnie Zamora stood in 1964 and saw the little gully where this thing, he claimed that there was an egg-shaped, a white egg-shaped ship of some sort with symbols on the side of it, and two little creatures in white outfits, like spacesuits, you know. Standing beside it, and he's looking down at this, and he says, "What is this?" And the two entities, let's call them, Zamora tried to move closer, and they apparently heard him, saw him, and they clambered back in their ship, and there was a loud explosion, and the ship took off and flew away in the distance, and then it zipped up out of the atmosphere and was gone. Now, unfortunately, Zamora passed away just before we were... Actually, we were going to meet with Zamora in December, but he passed away just 2 weeks before we were due to, you know, meet with him. And so the explanation... That because this was a, you know, this, I remember this because the UFO subject had been dead for a couple years until this Zamora case. And given that he was a sheriff's deputy and, you know, he seemed sober and well respected, talking about a close encounter, which is what it was.
He was on duty at the time, in fact.
I'm sorry?
He was on duty at the time.
He was on duty at the time, absolutely. He was in a cruiser, and he was in hot pursuit of a speeder. And so everything seemed to, you know, he was not, this didn't happen out in the farmer's field. It happened in metropolitan Socorro, on the edge of town, but still within Socorro. And he's talking about a couple entities and a spaceship that flew away, egg-shaped, and... So he reports to his superior, and they give him a lie detector test, and you could even see the imprints. There were four imprints in the ground where the legs of this egg-shaped object had apparently four struts going down, holding it up, and they left an imprint in the ground. And what they did, and it also, when it took off, there was a flash of flame and one of the bushes started burning. So there was, you know, a burnt bush and physical traces. So this was a physical trace case. It was also a close encounter of the third kind, where you actually see entities. And they go out there to investigate. J. Allen Hynek came in from the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago, where both Don and I used to, won't say be employed because we weren't paid anything, but we were on the board of directors. And the conclusion was that it seemed like a real solid case. And
Of the things that I think...
The thing was, I just wanted to get to the Air Force's explanation was that this was the moon, a test of the moon lander, okay? Now, the moon lander, you know what an erector set looks like? It's a bunch of little things you get for Christmas when you're a kid. You know, you build all these things, but they're these little metal pieces that don't look like anything, but you can make them into something. That's what the moon lander looked like. You know, it was just all pipes and struts and... no real fuselage, you know. So that was the official explanation. But the thing was, the moon lander was out in California, I believe, at the time. It was either California or Florida, nowhere near Socorro, New Mexico, to fly around and scare the local population. So
there's one thing that I find very interesting, because in that particular case, is that one of the biggest skeptics on Project Blue Book was its director, Major Hector Quintanilla.
Quintanilla, yep.
Quintanilla. You know, his view on that, that's one of the only times that he actually came forward in his official report and said that, you know, he was a big debunker in the whole case, but that was the one time he actually said that that case, he had no explanation for.
Well, you know, in that gully, they still have, they placed rocks, they picked up rocks and placed them in a circle around where each imprint was. The imprints are gone now because of erosion, but those rocks that they placed are still there. And Don and I, we went there this December with the last person to interview Zamora, which he did, I think, that summer. He's a local Socorro historian named Paul Harden, and we went with Paul to the site because there was some attempt this year. No, I take that back. We're in 2010. In mid 2009, there was an attempt by another investigator to say that this was a college prank. Now, there are so many imponderables in this case to fool the deputy sheriff. He had to be going by this place at the right time to see it. It's just ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the way the flight pattern was described to us by Paul Hardin, who had gotten it from Lonnie himself, because he interviewed Lonnie Zamora at the site last fall. And there's no way a college balloon could make these long distance high speed maneuvers and then fly up out of the atmosphere. It just doesn't make any sense. But that particular attempt got a lot of play this past summer. But Don and I, and certainly Paul Hardin, who interviewed Lonnie Zamora, there's just no way that that was a moon lander or a college prank.
Well, there's another point you made, too, with regard to the moon lander. When you were talking about its structure, we're talking about the New Mexico desert here, very rough and tough environment. That moon lander was actually designed very, very, very lightweight. It was practically made out of the same material as a cigarette lighter pack, aluminum foil, and very, very lightweight aluminum struts. You're talking, even the glass in that thing, believe it or not, space is not a very difficult environment. You know, you have no air pressure. You have to concern yourself with the pressure inside the vehicle, not outside pressure. It's the reverse of going down into under the water, you know, where the pressure's all there. The pressure's really inside the vehicle, not outside the vehicle. So, you know, it's a very lightweight vehicle. The moon lander was a very lightweight. You know, it's just like a spacesuit. If a piece of debris goes through it, it's very easy to puncture. And this is not something, you know, this is a multi-million dollar vehicle. You're not going to drop it out there or try to land it in the middle of a desert. Because if one thing goes wrong with that, you've lost millions of dollars worth of research and development.
Well, this was actually a very uneven terrained gully. Is what it was. It was a gully, a lot of rocks, a lot of bumps and furrows and things like that. I just can't imagine. This program. I don't know if back then it was Apollo or
that was Apollo. Name? That was Apollo. The landing program was Apollo. The prior program was Mercury.
Mercury. Yeah. Why they would. Land it in this gully in Socorro, taking a chance on injury to somebody or damage to the lander, or frightening the citizens of Socorro. It just doesn't add up. And then when you throw in the maneuvers that this thing made when it took off, at least according to Lonnie Zamora. There's just no explanation for it that is prosaic or you know, something that we would understand.
Well, the vehicle was only designed. It was designed to literally fly in space, where you don't have aerodynamics to be concerned with. You know, a little air will push you one way or the other, or a little It's not designed aerodynamically to fly within the Earth's atmosphere. So you have no direction. You can only go up or down with thrust. You thrust up or thrust down. That's it.
And this thing had a fuselage, you know, at least it was egg-shaped. You know, it had a exterior to the ship. Well, a moon lander, at least my recollection of it is that it didn't. It was just all you know, struts and stuff like that. There was still no real fuselage to it. So
yeah, without wings and some type of aerodynamic means to go horizontally, fly horizontally, that vehicle, a moon lander, cannot fly that way within the Earth's atmosphere. It was not designed to do that. It can simply go up if there's a means to propel itself, just like a rocket. A rocket can only go up.
This thing, according to Zamora, it rose up slowly but quickly, gained speed, and it flew across the road and approached some mountains that were like 10 miles in the distance in a matter of seconds. And then it flew along the mountain chain, and then it just went up out of sight in a matter of seconds. Now, I don't know of any college prank that could do that. I don't think the moon lander could do that. So he describes something that is beyond, at least back then, was beyond our capability. And so that's where the case has been left, because Zamora is no longer with us. But it's the case that has stood the test of time. Like you say, even those who questioned UFOs, they had to stop and think about it after the Zamora case, because of who made the report, what he was reporting, and what the possibilities were.
All right, you earlier mentioned something about other governments releasing information.
Okay.
About what? About UFOs. You know, we were talking earlier about freedom of information and how our government hasn't disclosed. There's a question from, I believe it's Wes in the chat room, wanted mm-hmm. me to ask you if what you said is true about other governments doing that, then why did the KGB issue an official statement on how the Soviet Army should handle UFO sightings?
Well, of course, UFOs are unidentified flying objects. There's no judgment as to whether they're terrestrial or extraterrestrial. They're just unknown. So my guess is, without having read it, I would guess they would hide behind, well, we're just talking about unidentified objects. So whether it's a, you know what I mean? That's what they do.
Okay. All right.
Don't we have like a, what is it, a fireman's manual, where there's some instructions how to handle UFOs?
Yeah, it's actually the fireman's. I believe it's in every firehouse. It has to do with the disaster relief.
Yes.
Yeah, disaster relief, and it actually says what to do with the UFO. It's actually in there, and most proponents of the government's aspect of it claim that it's any foreign body, such as a meteor or a crashed satellite or anything like that. But and that's what they say, but specifically says UFO.
Right, and the UFO boss would say, oh, well, they're talking about spaceships. Well, the firehouse would say, well, no, we're talking about UFOs. So, meaning unidentified flying objects, whatever they are, a meteor, you know, something that just flew down from that they didn't recognize immediately, could be anything. But they would say, oh, no, we're not talking about spaceships from Mars.
Hmm. What do you think about that, Reed? I'd like to know Reed's opinion on what.
I don't know if you want to know my opinion.
I don't know.
Skeptic,
yeah, I
want to
know. What you think. Yeah,
you
know, I want to know.
It's hard for me because I've actually wanted to ask this question for a while now. Is if Roswell was true and we were visited by aliens from other planets, where have they been since Roswell?
What have they?
Where have they been? Why have they come back to us? I mean, are they hiding themselves now, or there's something that?
What UFO? Yeah, there I go. You mean spaceships?
I mean any type of intelligent life from another planet, not from Earth. I mean, if Roswell was true, and there was someone who visited us from another planet, I mean, you would think they'd be back by now. You know?
Well, there's more UFO reports than ever. Just look on the internet.
Yeah, I know, but there are, you know what? And to look at the UFO reports, yeah, there are a lot of reports. But you know what? And I deal with the paranormal a lot, and not so much ufology. A little bit, though. I mean, you think they'd make their presence known. I mean...
Now you're anthropomorphizing. You're assuming they think like us.
No, I would never assume that. My problem with the whole thing is where people do assume they're like us, and they are probably, in all likelihood, not like us, because other life forms from other planets will not evolve like humans. We are unique here on the Earth, and that's been proven by scientists where, you know, the two eyes, the two ears, the one mouth is very unique to Earth because of the way the Earth works and the way the environment is. So other aliens would not be like us on Earth. So,
unless they came from an Earth-like planet,
you know what? That's there may be a chance of that. But if you take and you look at all the worlds out there and all the likelihood of other, an alien life form is a very tricky term, because if you use alien life form, they're looking now maybe on the moons of Saturn. There might be life there, because we found life just this past week. Underneath the ice, where there is no light, there is where we previously thought there could be no possibility of something living being there, but shrimp and jellyfish are living underneath there and frolicking and being happy, and they love where they're at. So we're looking at life on other planets where we previously thought there couldn't be life. But they're more than likely, you know what, you can toss the dice. I mean, we all go to Vegas. What are the chances of those dice hitting what we guessed the first time? You know what I mean? And we're talking about that times what, you know? And so if you're going to think that life's going to look like us, I think it's kind of an egotistical thing, kind of like we expect, we kind of think that ghosts are going to have ears and voice boxes to talk to us, where we expect alien life to be like us, where they're going to resemble us. And I think that's very egotistical of us, much like we think that our creator is going to look like us. You know, I think the possibility is it's there. I mean, I wouldn't say that I know all and be all. I don't know all this. But I think the possibility is very, very infinitesimally small.
Well,
you know,
here's what I think is that I think the... just like you go to the bottom of the sea, you know, the deepest parts of the ocean, there's life. Mm-hmm. I believe that life in the universe is the norm rather than the exception.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I believe that there are statistically enough other planets out there in the billions that have life. And I would guess that some of them have life, while not exactly like us, something... similar, like bilateral symmetry, brain.
If you look up the research, I mean, there's a lot of scientists, and you know what, on both sides, to be fair, but it tends to fall on the side where there's not bilateral symmetry, you know, where it's probably not going to work that way in other places.
Well, what we've discovered, what, like 400 planets, extrasolar planets.
We don't know any planets that support life as we know it. And as scientists look, most of the planets are not going to support us being bilateral symmetry. I mean,
I think statistically it's a certainty, but I can't prove it by finding one.
You know what? To be fair, that's debatable. Yeah, so I'd have to give you that point.
Because there's, 100 billion galaxies, right? Mm-hmm. And within each galaxy, there's, a billion stars, 100
yeah,
billion
exactly.
stars.
So we'd have to concur on the likelihood falling on our side. You know, there is life other places, whatever it may consist of, or, you know, if it looks like us or whatever, there's some type of life somewhere else. And to think we're the only ones... is very
see,
fluid.
And if you subscribe that the Roswell incident was a real event, which I do, at this point, the evidence that we've amassed is overwhelming, and the descriptions of the bodies, they were bilaterally symmetrical,
yeah.
with a head and two arms, two legs, that sort of thing. They were certainly didn't look like Hollywood movie stars.
Yeah, you know, and that's all eyewitness testimony, which we have to agree where eyewitness testimony, people want things to look like things that they're familiar with.
Well, we have enough descriptions from different people from different walks of life, everything from military.
But the walk of life thing doesn't fly with me because it doesn't matter your walk of life. You want things to look like things you're familiar with. They're just reporting what they saw. Yeah,
I'm
but if we look in the clouds, we want to see things. We see an elephant
I'm
there.
I'm not going to get into this.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 Fruitless
we're
from my point of view.
Yeah. Okay. Well, our brains are evolved.
The nature of the universe, you can take a hike as far as I'm concerned.
You know what? But our brains are evolved to want to find things we're familiar with. And you know what? If you want to tell me to take a hike, you know what, my friend? You are ignorant. I'm done with this. That's ignorant to say the least, because that's the way we are evolved on this planet.
Gentlemen, let's
I'm out of here.
Yeah, good night. Right, well, have a nice ignorant life. Go ahead. Goodbye. I'm sorry, but you know what? I can only do this for so long.
Right. I'll tell you what. We're coming up on the half hour.
We can take a break now. That's fine with me. Every dog has his day.
Well, I've drunk to drown on every ocean I've been. Lake Tanganyika, where the crocodiles swim. Halifax, Nova Scotia, to Van Diemen's Land. Well, I drank with the Sultan in the Suez Canal. Cause every dog has its day. Like every woman, she gets her own way. And if there's a ship that sails tonight, I'll captain that too. Like
I want to apologize about that last blow up, but you know what? Sometimes I have to speak my mind. This has been Dread Radio. Have a great evening.